You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
I mean, I wish I was the co-leader. But, I don't wish I was the co-leader. That's a terrible thing to say. I'm not
first,
James.
BFM.
I was just saying, I'm sorry that I cannot deliver on being the co-leader of the Green Party. Both James Shaw and Marama Davidson are busy. So they've sent the number 7 on the list to fill the gap.
Yes, that's right. We have Chloe Swarbrick in.
What a gaffe. This is a great start to this interview.
It's going
to
be a sting. It's going to be a sting.
No. Great. Love being a politician. It's all soundbite environment, eh?
So last week, your election access fund bill passed its first reading in Parliament unanimous support. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So the aim of the bill is to establish a fund to remove or reduce barriers to standing in general elections for those with disabilities. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Well, mate, you've kind of summarised it really well. In a nutshell, it basically creates a fund administered by the Electoral Commission, which is obviously an independent organisation which facilitates our general elections every 3 years. They would be responsible for administrating this fund to make the general election more accessible to candidates and voters, whether that be by way of, you know, providing some of that funding to NGOs who are seeking to distribute material, educating people about the positions of different political parties, for political parties to be able to facilitate more accessible internal processes, particularly for candidates with disabilities and for candidates themselves. So to kind of put that in context, the UK had a really similar fund during its 2012 to 2014 kind of election process, and it spent $500,000 New Zealand dollars for a population 16 times our size. We spend the last general election that we had in 2017, we spent around $35 million. So it's an absolute drop in the bucket, if you put that in perspective. But it's all about essentially just moving towards a more robust representative democracy. It was originally drafted by Mojo Mathers in the final few weeks of the 51st Parliament, and when Mojo came into our caucus at the start of the 52nd Parliament, just after I'd been elected and Gowrie's had been elected and we'd formed the new caucus, just before actually we'd formed the new government, Mojo was speaking about this bill, and given that one of the things that really gets me going is accessibility of democracy, I was really keen to take it on.
Right, so you don't expect it to cost very much.
Well, I mean, what's the cost of a good functioning democracy?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not cheap. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the kind of proponents of, you know, conservative, smaller government, all of that kind of thing, which was some of the rhetoric that I heard during the bill's first reading, people saying that political parties should not be relying on state funding. They should be, you know, generating this funding themselves by way of fundraising or otherwise. I think those people neglect to realise that the political parties presently actually already get funding through the state. For example, one really good example is the broadcasting fund that they receive for election advertising. In the last general election, that was to the tune of $4 million. And again, putting that in the context of what the UK spent $500,000 New Zealand dollars for a population 16 times our size, it's just incomparable. So in terms of the cost and the massive benefit that we would have towards moving towards a more representative democracy, yeah, it's a real drop in the bucket.
So in practice, if all goes well and the bill passes its final stage, how might the 2020 elections look different?
So, just picking up on that point around should all go well and it pass through its final stages. So just for sake of clarity, and not presuming anybody is aware of this really convoluted parliamentary process, which I engage in daily, we've just passed the first reading, right? It is now before the Governance and Administration Select Committee. What's really cool about the Select Committee process is that we're opening the doors for people around the country to have their say on, you know, sharing their life experiences and engaging in elections, where they'd like to see it go further in particular, how they see that it would play out in practicality and how we can improve the legislation and indeed the fund and those delegated powers to the Electoral Commission. So that is a really crucial process, and that's going to take a few months. So the Select Committee will report back to the House probably towards the end of this year. At that point, we'll go into the second reading. And then at that point, after the second reading, should that pass, we'll go to Committee of the Whole House, where it's torn apart again. I get to sit up just in front of the Speaker, and it's quite a weird process. and everyone can debate for as long as they like. That's often where filibustering happens in the House, should it happen. I don't expect that it'll happen around this bill because there is a sense of unanimity, which is something I've been working on quite hard behind the scenes. And then it'll go to the third reading, and should it pass the third reading, it's then just because we operate in a constitutional monarchy, be rubber stamped by the Governor General on behalf of the Queen. So, I am expecting, and I have been working really, really constructively, actually, with members from all sides of the House and having ongoing conversations about their concerns and issues with the bill and, you know, the way that it's manifest. Everybody generally agrees with the intention and the thrust around accessibility of democracy, but certain individuals, MPs from certain parties, are concerned about, for example, political parties receiving the funding. The really cynical side is people who are concerned about, for example, certain political parties signing up a number of candidates with disabilities and then not genuinely, running those candidates. So, yeah, it's just about navigating those kinds of concerns and about ensuring that there's transparency, accountability and accessibility of the process. I also think there's something really exciting in the potential for the Select Committee. There has been a little bit of a buzz on that echo chamber called Twitter, where people have been speaking to how inaccessible the Select Committee process currently is, and how it is really difficult to know how you should be putting in a submission. And, you know, obviously there are all sorts of new barriers which crop up should you be a person who's disabled by that system. So we are going to be this week attempting to meet with the Clerk of the House. The Clerk of the Select Committee as well as the Clerk of the House. The Clerk of the House was actually really, really good and worked with me on getting New Zealand Sign Language interpreters on the screen during the first reading and making it as accessible as possible. We also brought Mojo up from the South Island to the House for it. So she had her interpreters who were typing to screen while she was sat in there, which was really rad. And we'll be working with the Clerk of the Select Committee and members of the Select Committee to ensure that we end up with the most accessible process for Select Committee. So we might be running a bit of a trial in terms of what that actually looks like, and then producing some form of report to say this is actually how we should do things better beyond the scope of what we're doing with the Election Access Fund bill. I said it in my speech, it's demonstrable what kind of things we can achieve if we make accessibility a priority. What if we actually made it normality?
Do you think the bill, in regards to democracy in all settings, do you think the bill goes far enough? What about accessibility for local body elections?
Bingo. So the issue there is that it's actually just the convoluted way that our electoral processes are set up. So the Electoral Commission does not deal with the funding for local body candidates. So that's just, we would have to have a separate piece of legislation which would amend the way that funding process works to do that. So this is basically just a nudge in the right direction. It's definitely not going to solve all issues when it comes to accessibility, that's for sure. And I also just want to highlight that there are quite a few people who came and spoke to me and said, not all people with disabilities want to be politicians. And I absolutely recognise that not all people want to be politicians. Yeah. But and in New Zealand, we don't coerce people to engage in the political sphere. But should people want to engage in the political sphere, there should be no barriers. So that's the point of this legislation. Talking about whether it goes far enough, this is about recognising that right now there are a whole bunch of people who face those barriers that others simply don't. But absolutely we need to continue progressing, thinking about different forms of inaccessibility that are perpetuated by the status quo of the system that we've presently got, and how that, I would argue indoctrinates kind of an elitist vibe. But anyway, the Canadian model of this Election Access Fund bill actually goes quite a bit further and opens up funding for childcare for single mothers or fathers. So I absolutely think there's scope to do something like that, but I'm also wary of conflating the conversation, and I absolutely want this to focus at the moment on the rights of persons with disabilities and fulfilling our obligations under Article 39 of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
Fantastic. Well, we'll move on to the EFTS loan cap. So medical students are upset with the government for not getting rid of the cap on the number of years a student can get a student loan. So the national government put the eight-year cap in place in 2011, and it was opposed by the Labor Party and many students' associations.
And the Greens.
And the Greens, yes. Particularly medical ones, but extending the cap is not part of the new budget. So, Chloe, what's to be made of all this? I understand The Green Party supports a universal postgraduate student allowance and an increase in the allowance rate for all students.
Yes, we absolutely do. So I just to clarify a few things. So the EFTS that it's currently sits at 8 years, and as you mentioned, it was brought into effect by the National Party in 2011 when they were in government. Basically what it does is it caps the amount of years that somebody can apply for a student loan. So it's estimated, I believe, actually by the Medical Students Association as of last year, that there's about 142 students who are directly affected by this who are medical students. Indicative of the funding model, which is broken at the moment when it comes to student finances. So, the EFTS limit introduced in 2011 by the Nats, the Greens and Labour opposed it. It essentially caps the amount of funding that students can get for studying both undergrad and postgrad to a maximum of 8 years. That's fine if you're coming straight out of uni and going directly into a med degree. If you're not, if you have to do a bridging course or some other courses in order to get into that med degree, then you are affected and you might end up in a situation where you cannot get funding for your final or second, you know, last 2 years of med school, which, as I think has been pointed out by the Medical Students Association, is just absolutely illogical. Why would we fund 6 years of somebody's degree and not the final two, especially when we have not enough doctors in this country? So it's absolutely something which I'm actively working on, as well as, you know, the affordability of studying for students in, across this country. So in talking about student allowances and postgrad student allowances and moving towards universality, those are all things which we're also working on. I think it's important to note that all of this is happening in the context of massive reform across the education sector, which is by no means a small feat. It's from ECE, so early childhood education, the compulsory sector, so from primary through intermediate through high school, and in the tertiary space. So we're doing a massive amount of work in all of this at the moment. One thing that I'm really proud of in this budget is the funding that's gone on into inclusive education. So as of next year, through AUS funding, there'll be 1,000 more kids with special needs who are going to be able to access the help that they need to be able to participate in education, which is really awesome, and one of the items in our confidence and supply agreement. But another one of the items in our confidence and supply agreement is making tertiary study more affordable for students. So just on the point of practicality, we as the Green Party are 8 MPs of 120 in the House. We are one of three government parties, and we are negotiating and working our best to get this across the line. I'm actively working as the Green Party's education spokesperson with both Minister Chris Hipkins, obviously of the Labour Party, and Associate Minister Tracy Martin in the education space to ensure that we do see some changes from the next budget at the very least.
Yeah, on med students, so How short are we on doctors in this country?
I don't have those figures off the top of my head, but I could absolutely get them back to you.
Okay. And so for early childhood, on early childhood education, there's been a lot of criticism around special needs not being met, particularly mm-hmm. around dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So will we see any change on that?
Yeah, so on that point, I am not sure if you're aware, but it was either last year or the year prior that Catherine Delahunty kind of led and worked with Chris Hipkins, Tracy Martin, and some of the National Party members of what used to be the Education and Science is now the Education and Workforce Select Committee to prompt a select committee inquiry into the state of education for kids with dyslexia, dyspraxia, and a number of other kind of needs that aren't currently being met by the system. So that is part of our confidence and supply agreement to meet those needs. Speaking to ECE in particular, we are underway in reviewing that process, and there was, as announced by the Prime Minister pre-budget, there will be more funding going into identifying those needs and ensuring that we help those kids. But again, it's about ensuring that we help those kids in a way which doesn't, you know, set them up for a life where they're being pigeonholed and told that they are, you know, that this is going to define them. It's about ensuring that they have the support to, you know, achieve what they want to achieve. It's about ensuring that we don't have a system which disables them. So, yeah, basically that's what we're working towards at the moment.
But I think the issue is that, you know, if you don't actually diagnose the issue in the first place, and to diagnose it, it costs around an extortionate amount of money. So right now, if you don't have the money, you can't get diagnosed. You're going to hinder them from being able to achieve everything that they can achieve regardless of whether they're disabled, they just might be labelled as naughty.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's a, like, bingo, you've hit the nail on the head. And as they move through the system, they might be excluded or suspended or otherwise. And that actually points to another thing which I'm working on, which is working on a better system around expulsions and suspensions, because my understanding is that New Zealand is one of the very few countries in the world where you don't have that appeal process in place, and that by far and away the majority of kids who are being suspended or expelled are those who do have learning difficulties. And as indicated by a whole raft of research in the likes of the USA, that is a pipeline to prison, which relates quite closely to what the previous interview was about with Just Speak. You know, this is not an issue which is happening in a vacuum. You know, if we're talking about criminal justice, if we're talking about the environment, if we're talking about education, if we're talking about housing, if we're talking about the cost of living, all of those things are required to look at if we are going to have a holistically successful society, which probably segues quite well into you know, the fact that as of next year, the government is going to be creating its budgets off the back of a wellbeing index, which we're creating, which will incorporate all of those things.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Chloe.
Cheers, Chloe. Man, always. Not at number 7 on the Green Party list.
And BFM alumni.
You got it, mate.
Great to have you back, as always.
Get you later.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.